Okay, so we're looking through the way Exodus chapter 21 is structured, and we notice how everything dealt after the rules of slaves at the beginning, everything after that dealt with crimes for which there is a capital penalty. And now, and kind of in the order of the bigger chidush of the, not only is this thing a capital crime, but this is also a capital crime. Yosef Achor Shor pointed out and says, of course, murder is a capital crime, and then says that sometimes, like, if you strike somebody and you don't kill them, it could still be a capital crime if that person that you strike happens to be your parent. And then kidnapping, and then cursing. And then we get to the problem of defining what constitutes murder. How can you tell that something is murder? And so here are verses that give us a formula for telling us whether something is or is not murder. So I'll read the verses in English. When they quarrel, and one strikes the other with stone or fist, and he does not die, but has to take to his bed. If he then gets up and walks outdoors upon his staff, the assailant shall go unpunished, except that he must pay for his idleness and his cure. Okay, so the Hebrew side here, I put in red the words that we are going to spend the most time talking about. There are three interpretive problems related to this verse, and these are the three major interpretive problems that we will deal with today. But before we get to those interpretive problems, just see like the standard rabbinic understanding of what this verse is saying. So the verse said that if he gets up and he starts to walk around, then the assailant shall go unpunished. It's not, you won't punish him. To which Rashi asked the obvious question. Could it cross your mind that they would, what are they saying? That the guy hasn't died, and that it would be a capital crime? Could you admit? It couldn't mean that. Ella. Rashi says, rather, the text teaches you that he is kept incarcerated until we discover whether the other, the one who was hit, is healed. What the verse implies is, when this man, the one who was injured, rises again and walks outdoors, al mishanto, then the one who struck him shall be released. But so long as the injured party has not risen, then the man who struck him is to be incarcerated, because we don't know whether this was murder or not. So how are we going to be able to tell whether something is or is not murder? Well, we're going to have to wait. So I guess the kind of question that the standard rabbinic understanding of this verse is giving, and I think the standard rabbinic understanding of the verse is basically the pshat of the verse. So we say that X strikes Y, and Y dies a week later, a month later, a year later, 5 years later. How can we tell whether to attribute the death of Y to X? I'm not an expert in modern law or in modern medicine, but in all the crime-related, mystery-related books and television shows that I look at, there's always a pathologist who comes and testifies and says that he or she did an autopsy and discovered that the cause of death was thus and such, and then you know what the cause of death is. However, in biblical times, the pathology was not particularly a well-developed art. And so how can you tell whether the striking was that which led to the death of the person who was struck? And the principle here is that if after being struck, this person was in bed the whole time, and unable to walk around on his or her own, and then dies, then we say that the striking was what led to death. But if that person gets up and walks around outside and then dies after that, then we say that the death is not attributable to the striking. And then, as the verse said, all you have to do is pay for the fact that the person was idle, you know, the unemployment insurance for the time when he was, when the person who was struck was unable to go to work, and the doctor bills. We'll talk about that. And some of you who have studied rabbinic literature will know that actually the rabbis say that there are five different kinds of payments that have to be made if you strike somebody without killing them. In addition to these two categories, shevet and ripui, idleness and cure, there's also damage. If you inflicted damage on somebody in such a way that, let's say that their arm is now crooked or something like this, that could be, or if they lost part of a limb or something like that, that there'd be a payment for damages. And then there's also pain and suffering that is assessed. And there is also a payment sometimes for embarrassment. So in rabbinic literature, they expand this and say that there are actually five things that an assailant has to pay for, and that the person who was hit is assessed in these five different kinds of ways to figure out what the damage was, what the idleness was, what the cost of the cure was, what the embarrassment factor was, and how much pain and suffering the person had. So let's say the text is saying here, in the case that it isn't murder, then there are these payments. And how can you tell whether it was murder or not if the person did not die right away? And they give you this formula that he gets up and he walks outdoors upon his staff. Then if that has happened, then he dies after that, then we say that the death is not attributable to the striking in the first place. So that's standard rabbinic understanding of the text. Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, offers what seems to be an extremely unusual understanding of the Hebrew word here, egrof. And anybody who speaks modern Hebrew knows what an egrof is. An egrof is a fist, as the translation here says, of the JPS, with a stone or with a fist. Many years ago, I took a course with one of the greatest experts in the history of the Hebrew language, Professor Moshe Goshen Gottstein. And I remember one time, he was talking about how the meanings of various words change over the years. And he talked about the word sama, sadi men hey, which in modern Hebrew means a braid. And he said that nobody has any real certainty about what sama means in the Bible. And he thinks that the most reasonable explanation is that sama in the Bible means forehead. And there was an Israeli in the class who started to laugh about the idea of sama meaning forehead, when everybody knows that sama means a braid. And Professor Goshen Gottstein was a great scholar, but also had quite a temper. He started yelling at the student and saying, "You think because you know how to speak modern Hebrew, then you know the meaning of every word in the Bible?" I remember we were all shaking in our boots listening to this professor berating a graduate student in a university. I don't know if that happens anymore on campuses, but in my days as a student, it would happen. So the question is, just because we know, in quotation marks, that egrof means fist, does it mean fist? So Rashbam says, no, it doesn't mean fist. He says, Lefi Apshat, according to the plain meaning of scripture, egrof is to be understood the same way as it is understood by the Targum, by Targum Onklus, who translates it as kurmiza, which he says, means some type of stone or brick. And Rashbam continues, the context of the verse also proves this interpretation as it deals with throwing a stone. Rashbam says, this is a very strange verse here. If you think that egrof means fist, he struck the other one either with a stone or with a fist. You know, a stone is something separate from me. A fist is part of my body. I guess the text could say that, and that's what JDS says, but it's saying if you strike with something outside of your body, or if you strike with your body, with the fist itself. Rashbam says no, and he also says that that's how Onklus, in translation that's almost 2,000 years old, the Aramaic, that it's the Hebrew word kurmisa. Rashbam, as the careful researcher that he was, he said, and how do I know that the Aramaic word kurmisa means a type of stone or brick? Because I found a similar usage concerning the verse, they will pull out the stones of Anim, or the Torah Kohanim, there's a rabbinic commentary on Leviticus from the early years of the first millennium, writes, perhaps he is also obligated to pull out not only all the stones, but also the bricks and the turmusin. It seems like Rashbam thought that the word there was kurmusin, which he thought was like the word kurmiza. And also, there is one other verse in the Bible that uses the word egrof, a famous phrase that we know from the Haftarah and from Isaiah that we recite on Yom Kippur in the morning. It talks about one who strikes with an egrof. And he says, oh, that also means a stone. It doesn't mean striking with a fist. It means striking with a stone. With a stone large enough that it could cause death and cause damage. And if you see here on this slide, I'm giving you a possible explanation of what the word kurmisa could come from. It could come from the Greek word keramos, which means pottery, and our English word ceramic comes from this Greek word keramos, and so it's possible that when Onklus said here in his translation that egrof means a kurmisa, I looked in Jastrow's dictionary. I'm not the biggest expert either in Aramaic or in Greek. And Jastrow, who wrote what's usually considered the definitive dictionary of Talmudic Aramaic, Jastrow says that kurmisa means fist. And there is a rabbinic saying in Aramaic, l'chakima beremisa, ulishatya bekarmiza. To a smart person, it's sufficient to hint at something. But when you're talking to a fool, sometimes you have to raise a fist. That's how Jastrow understood this phrase. So he doesn't think that Rashbam's proof here is much of a proof. Rashbam claiming that actually what Onklus is saying here must be must be that Onklus is saying that it is a stone. However, there is another problem that we have with this text, and that is that. So we go back to how the original translators of the like the oldest rabbinic commentary on Shmot, the Mechilta, again, close to 2,000 years ago, what it says about the words here. Could it be that the murderer is liable to punishment only if it was done with a stone or with a grof? And the Mechilta says, no. That is why it says that he struck him with a stone tool that could cause theft. It's another verse that talks about intentional homicide in the book of Numbers. He struck him, the victim, with a stone tool that could cause death. This teaches us that he is liable only if he's struck with an item that is potentially lethal. So the Mechilta says, and I think this is a principle in Jewish law, and I think that this is a principle in every Western legal system, that you can be convicted of murder if you struck somebody with something only if it is a potentially lethal thing. If you throw your glasses case at somebody and it hits them and they fall in a funny way and they die through some strange combination of events, I don't think that anybody would ever call that first degree murder. It was a terrible thing to do. It might be second degree murder, but it isn't first degree murder, because we have the idea that the murder weapon has to be something potentially lethal, or as the rabbis say, sheyesh bo kedei lahamitch, that the weapon was a weapon that could theoretically cause death. Which leads to the question of the eben ob egrof, is a fist a lethal weapon? So that is probably what was bothering Rashbam here. Rashbam looks at this text, and he says that there's the possibility that this is going to be considered murder, but it says that the action took place either with a stone or with an egrof, and if egrof means a fist, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Again, I'm not an expert on this, but I have I've read that that if you are a professional boxer, your fists can be considered a lethal weapon, but my fist is not considered a lethal weapon. And so it would seem strange that the biblical law is saying here that it happened if the killing took place with a stone or with a fist. And the Torah commentary of Menachem Ben Chizkiya, called the Chizkuni Torah commentary, that's in a large sense based on Rashbam's understanding of the biblical text, he makes this explicit. He follows in the footsteps of Rashbam, and he writes here, Be'egrof means with a stone, as the Targum renders before Misa, so also in Torah Kohanim, he quotes Rashbam. In other words, he struck him with a stone that could kill someone, that it's a stone that could be a lethal weapon. For if you imagine that egrof means a fist, what is the meaning of the phrase, he strikes the other and he does not die? Do we expect someone to die from being hit by a fist? So the reading of this biblical text through the eyes of later rabbinic law, which became, as to the best of my knowledge, later international law that says that murder has to consist of this, if something's going to be first degree murder, then we have to have a lethal weapon. That is probably what led to this dispute. Ramban, in his Torah commentary, says, according to the rabbis, egrof is the hand closed tightly with the fingers gathered into the palm in order to strike someone. He defines what a fist is. Scripture thus mentioned two kinds of hitting, a hard one with a stone and a lighter one with a fist, which in most cases does not cause death, teaching that in both cases, an estimate of the power of the stone or the fist is needed, and the assailant is meanwhile incarcerated. So you need two things to be assessed. You need to decide whether whether this person has healed from the original striking, and we also have to assess whether the weapon that was used is something that an assailant could reasonably understand might have been a lethal weapon that could cause death. And then Ramban says, others say that egrof is actually a clod of earth, and that it isn't a fist. Presumably, those others that he is referring to are troubled by the same idea here. They want to interpret the text in such a way Mishnah, they want to interpret the text in such a way that it is clear that we are dealing with something that could, in potential, be a deadly weapon. Okay, so that's the first issue that I want to deal with today, the dispute about what a grof means, which essentially leads us to the question of how you assess what a what is not a, how we assess whether a murderer should realize that that which he did is likely to lead to murder. Okay, and now we come to the second issue that I said we would deal with today, with the way of measuring whether the person has healed. So Rashi says that we incarcerate the assailant. I'm sure you all know that incarceration is not a common penalty in the Torah. It's actually never prescribed as the penalty for anything, but it is a method that is used for holding somebody until you decide what actually is going to be done. So that this person has committed a crime. The assailant has committed a crime, and we don't know whether the assailant has committed assault or whether the assailant has committed murder, and we have to wait, and we will see what the results are. And we're given this formula here, that if you see that the injured party is able to get up and walk around outside al nish anto, then we say, oh, clearly this wasn't murder. And the simple rabbinic understanding here is that, let's say this person gets up and is walking around outside on El Mishanto and then dies the next day, then we say, well, no, there was some other cause of death, and it wasn't because of the assault. The assault was not the factor that led to the death. Again, because we don't have a well-developed art of pathology in order to assess what the real cause of death was. Here, again, we find another surprising understanding of the biblical text. So first, our first surprise was that a grof might not mean a fist, the way we all of us who speak modern Hebrew assume that a grof should mean a fist. And then we see that mishanto might not mean a staff, a walking stick. Here's the... if he then gets up and he walks outdoors, JPS translation, upon his staff. A staff is a walking stick. It is possible that people in antiquity used walking sticks even more than we use walking sticks today, particularly if, you know, the roads aren't very well paved, if you're on a bumpy surface. A lot of people will walk around using a walking stick, not just elderly people. Rashi says that isn't what Mishanto means. Rashi says Mishanto means on his own strength, which seems to mean without a walking stick. He's walking around without actually leaning on anything. So the verb sha'an means to lean. So mishenet is a noun that usually means walking stick. But Rashi is saying, well, sha'an means to lean. So al mishanto means that he's like leaning on himself. He's not leaning on something else. He's just leaning on himself. Why does Rashi say this? It's not his invention. The Targum Unklus, those of you who can read the Aramaic, on the left-hand side, you see Unklus says, Im yakun bi'alech davara al borei. That's the Hebrew, the Aramaic equivalent of the Hebrew al borio. Al borei means on his own strength. Another ancient Aramaic translation, the Targum Yonatan, does not understand it that way. That the Targum Yonatan reads, In yakum mi ma'are, from his bed, and gets up from his bed, umahalef b'shuka, and he's walking around in the marketplace, al muranite. Muranite means on his walking stick. But in the Mechilta, again, the Midrash Halacha, the rabbinic text on Exodus that's close to 2,000 years old, the Mechilta says, Al Mishanto means on his own strength. And then an interesting comment in the Mechilta, this is one of the three biblical phrases that Rabbi Yishmael used to explain as figurative. We'll talk a little bit more when we get a little farther along in Parshat Mishpatim about figurative understandings of legal texts. There's a certain admission here in the Mechilta that, of course, the simple understanding of the word Mishanto means his walking stick, his staff. But Rabbi Yishmael is saying, no, we should understand it as figurative. Not as it isn't talking about a literal walking stick. It's talking about this person being able to walk on his or her own strength. So that's Rashi's somewhat surprising understanding here of Mishanto. Ibn Ezra says, Mishanto, as in the phrase, old men and women, each with their walking stick in their hand. A verse, beautiful, famous verse in the prophet Zechariah, who prophesies that Od yeshu zekeinim zekeinot berchovot Yerushalayim, that we will yet see many old men and old women in the streets of Jerusalem and in the part of Jerusalem where I live. We do see a lot of old men and old women, and he says each one of them with their walking stick, because they've lived to a ripe old age, and I do see that from time to time when I am here in Jerusalem. So Ibn Ezra says, okay, that's the simple understanding of Mishanto. But the rabbis taught that Al Mishanto means on his own strength, meaning that he won't lean on someone else when he gets up, but he'll stand up on his own strength. And then Ibn Ezra, as he often does, gives up. And he says, we will abandon the former explanation and we will rely on the latter explanation, since the second explanation has trustworthy witnesses. Rabbinic tradition is trustworthy. This old understanding of the Mechilta, he's abandoning this interpretation, not because Rashi said it. Ibn Ezra does not give in to Rashi on any regular basis, but he does give in to classical rabbinic literature on a frequent basis. And he says, okay, I give up. I thought that Mishenet meant a walking stick, but I'm going to abandon that interpretation because I see what the reliable rabbinic tradition has to say about this verse. Curiously, Ibn Ezra, who often is seen as being, not the most conservative, to put it mildly, of the medieval Jewish commentators. Some of you might know that Baruch Spinoza used to famously argue that Ibn Ezra did not believe that Moses could have been the author of the Torah. And Ibn Ezra is a bad boy from time to time, taking on unusual kinds of opinions. But in the bottom line, he kind of concedes to the halachic understanding, to the traditional Jewish halachic understanding. On the other hand, Ramban, who is normally considered to be the more conservative one, somehow here he takes the less conservative position. First of all, he quotes Rashi and Ibn Ezra, and then he says, in my opinion, Mishanto is to be understood in this literal sense as a staff, just as in the verses, each with the Mishanto in their hands for old age. Scripture is thus stating that if the injured person's health improves sufficiently to enable him to go out walking in the streets and in the broadways with his staff, like those healed from some prolonged injury, the assailant shall go unpunished. The question is, when do we say that we now are assuming that the death of the victim is not a result of the striking. And so it would seem like from the position of Rashi and of the Mechilta and of Ibn Ezra, we would only assume that if the injured party was able to walk on his or her own outside, only then would we say that they have been that they have been healed. But according to Ramban, even if the person is walking around using a walking stick, we will still say that they are to be considered to have been healed. And it further teaches us, Ramban says, that even if the injured man is careless later about his health and dies after that in his weakness, the assailant is free from the death penalty. Scripture says if he then gets up and walks outdoors, the assailant shall go unpunished, because it speaks of the most common occurrence. Injured people who are laid up in bed do not go outside walking again until their wounds have healed and they are out of danger. This is the sense of the phrase "and walks outdoors," because if he just gets up and walks in his own house on his staff and then dies, the assailant is not exonerated. So Ramban comes up with, one might say, a more lenient understanding of the text from the point of view of the assailant, a more stringent point of view from the point of view of the assaulted party. And it all comes down to the question of whether the word mishanto should be understood literally, or should it be understood figuratively, as Rabbi Yishmael suggests. Okay, and now we go on to the last issue that I want to look at today, the question of paying for healing. Again, just reviewing the in quarrel, one strikes the other with stone or fist, and he does not know, but he has to take to his bed. If he then gets up and walks outdoors upon his staff, the assailant shall go unpunished. We say that this clearly was not murder, but the assailant has to pay for his idleness and pay for his cure. A famous rabbinic text, again, back to Rabbi Yishmael, that we saw commenting on that word mishanto. Rabbi Yishmael thought that from the words "he must pay for his cure," from this we learned that permission has been given to doctors to heal. This might not sound all that controversial to you, because we all make use of physicians, but how do we know that it is permissible to go to a physician? Rabbi Yishmael says, well, if the Torah says that you pay the doctor bills, means that it's okay to use a doctor. So this is found both in the Mechilta and in the Babylonian Talmud. Baba Kama, the argument that from this verse we know that it is permissible to go to a physician for healing. And why is this at all controversial? Because we have another verse in the Torah that says, if you will heed the Lord your God diligently, doing what is upright in his sight, giving ear to his commandments and keeping all his laws, then I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought upon the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer. Ani Hashem Rofecha. And we all know that there are a number of religious groups, not Jewish religious groups, but there are religious groups who argue that that healing comes from God, and that it's not permissible to rely on physicians, because God is the one who the Torah says is our healer. So I think it's pretty likely that Rabbi Yishmael was acquainted with this problem, with the idea that somebody might decide on the basis of that verse later on in the book of Exodus, that healing comes from the Lord. And so he says, well, we have a verse here that says that when you assault somebody and you cause damage, you have to pay the doctor's bills. And so that kind of proves that it is permissible to go to a doctor. This has been, I would say, the majority Jewish approach throughout all documented Jewish history that I know about. But I just thought today that I would share with you some surprising texts that take a different kind of idea, a different kind of approach to this issue. So here's what Ibn Ezra says in his first commentary on Exodus. People will recall Ibn Ezra wrote two commentaries on Exodus, the first one when he lived in Italy, and the second one when he lived in France. Ibn Ezra writes, "The opinion that these words, 'he must pay for his cure, provide a license to doctors to heal,' is a minority opinion." He says, yeah, there's just one rabbi in the Talmud who says this. Rabbi Yishmael says this, but this is not the majority opinion. Or my opinion, or lefi da'ati, the true path is for a person to rely on the Creator and not on intelligence, neither on astrology nor on medicine. You know, it's funny. Ibn Ezra believed in that astrology works. He wrote books about astrology, but he said that the proper religious Jew should not rely on astrology, should rely directly on God. And he's so when he compares medicine here to astrology, it's not that he's insulting medicine, because he believes in astrology also, but he thinks that even though these things work, that a Jew should be striving to have a direct relationship with God. For the verse says, "I am the Lord, your healer." There's no need for another healer to be God's partner. So what's it going to do with this verse here that says that you have to pay the doctor's bill here, that if one person harms another person, he has to pay the doctor's bill? He comes up with an unusual idea. The wound in this verse comes from a person, so a person is able to heal it. But how could a person heal that which God has made ill? As the verse says about God, he smites and then he heals us. Yach v'yach b'shena. And so when we have an illness, when we have an injury that is not an external injury, then healing will come from God. Again, just pointing out what I think everybody here knows. This is not the standard later Jewish approach, and the standard later Jewish approach is, of course, like there's a partnership between the physician who's trying to heal us and God who's trying to heal us, and they work together with each other. I made a shiva call today on a friend of mine who's a psychiatrist, and we had a far-reaching discussion, and he said, he quoted Freud, who once said, "I can't deal with the following condition, only God can deal with that." And so he said that Freud had various things that he thought that he was not able to deal with, and that you rely on God. So that was in his first commentary on Exodus, and his second commentary on Exodus, he's still running on the same theme. He must pay for his cure. This proves that God has given doctors the right to heal wounds and sores that may be seen externally. However, any internal illnesses inside the human body are in God's hands to be healed. Now, let us recall that medieval medicine was not all that advanced. And when people had some kind of internal injury, it's not 100% clear what it is that many of the physicians could do for them. And even Ezra says that's in God's hands, and we don't have the physicians dealing with the illnesses. Chol shehu bifnim baguf, an illness that is inside of the human body. Even Ezra argues that's God's vision. And so this is a little surprising. Even more surprising than this is that a generation, two generations after even Ezra, Ramban says something very similar. And Ramban was a physician himself. And despite the fact that he was a trained practicing physician himself, it's curious to see the attitude that he had towards healing from physicians and from God. And again, I just want to repeat these texts that I'm looking at with you are not the standard Jewish position. The majority Jewish viewpoint over the years has always been very favorable to healing from physicians, but Ramban here says something pretty shocking about going to physicians. He writes, in general, if Jews all acted properly, God would not behave towards them in a natural manner at all. If we behave properly, God would treat us in essentially a miraculous manner. Our entire life would be miraculous. He would bless their bread and their water. He would remove all sickness from their midst so that they would require no doctors and would have no need for any medical precautions. And that is what the verse says, I am the Lord, your healer. This is what the righteous Jews did in the era of prophecy. When illness befell them, they went to a prophet and they didn't go to a doctor. Again, this does not sound like the Judaism that most of us know and practice. It does sound like some other religious groups that sometimes have attitudes like this, that you don't go to the physician, you just go to God's representative here on earth, for God's representative here on earth to help you to get to get healing from God. And that is what they said in the Talmud. An interesting quotation in the Talmud. Ein darkam shel b'nei adam berefuot ela shenahagu. It really isn't the way of people to use medicine, but it's the custom. You know, it's like the Gemara is saying, it's not a halacha, but it's a minhag. It's not Jewish law, but that's what people do. People go to doctors, and so we're not going to oppose going to doctors. In other words, if people avoided medicines, they would get ill when deserving of punishment for their sin, and they would be healed at God's desire. If you believe in providence, if you believe in reward and punishment, why shouldn't you believe, Ramban is saying, that if you misbehave, God will make you ill. And then if you improve yourself, if you do tshuva, if you repent, then God will take care of you. And Ramban is suggesting that would be a much better way of running the world instead of having people getting ill and running off to physicians. And they would be healed at God's desire. But people adopted the custom of medicine, so God abandoned them to the ways of nature. Because human beings decided that they were interested in medicine, that's why God allows nature to have an effect on us instead of God being the one who controls our lives in all senses. God abandoned people to the ways of nature, and that's why if you don't exercise caution about corona, you might get corona, not because that's not a sign that you've sinned, but because you did not exercise caution, and that God abandoned us to the ways of nature instead of us having us being in the hands of God, both for our illnesses and for our and for our healing. Just to emphasize again, I'm not saying that this is the Jewish position. I'm also not saying that this position that I like in particular myself, but it's interesting to see what medieval Jewish Bible commentators were doing with this phrase. Somebody like Rashi simply said that in this we know that that you can go to a physician, but Ibn Ezra and Ramban had more less positive views about going to physicians. And that is what the rabbis meant when they said, and provide that he be healed. From this we learn that permission has been given to doctors to heal. Here's an interesting argument that Ramban says. They did not say that permission was given to sick people to seek medicine. That to go to the physician, that decision, the rabbis did not take any position on whether it's okay to go to the physician. Rather, once patients become sick and they come to be healed because they opt for medicine, doctors, since they are expert practitioners, should not refrain from healing them out of fear that they will die under their care, nor because of the feeling that only God is the healer of all flesh. And this is because people adopted the custom of medicines. Ramban argues that the formulation here, Rabbi Yishmael's formulation here, that from this we learn that permission has been given to doctors to heal. He says that the text intentionally did not say permission has been given to patients to go to their physicians, but if they're going to the physicians, then it is permissible for the physicians. The physicians might have good reasons for refraining from healing. They might be concerned that they might not heal properly, or they might concern that they're stepping on the toes of God. And so that's why the Torah says that if the sick person comes to you and you're the physician, that you are allowed to try to heal them. So when people fight and they hit each other, the guilty party has to pay for the healing. For the rules of the Torah do not depend on miracles. But it might be that the ideal thing might be for the person who was injured to hope that God will heal him or her. But since the rules of the Torah do not depend on miracles, that's why physician can, if they go to a physician, you, the assailant, have to pay for the cost of the physician. But when people's actions are pleasing to God, then they have no need for doctors. The phrase that he uses here are "Birtzot Hashem Darkei Ish." It's a quotation from the book of Proverbs, and in the context it says there, "Birtzot Hashem Darkei Ish, Gam Oivav Yashlimu Imo." Even his enemies, if somebody's actions are pleasing to God, then he doesn't even have to worry about his enemies. And according to Ramban, he doesn't have to worry about going to a physician. And I just thought I'd finish off here, even though this isn't a Bible commentary, with a little interesting text that I just saw not too long ago from the writings of Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, the first chief rabbi of first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of the land of Israel, the famous Rabbi Cook wrote. This would be the case only if we were convinced that the opinions of doctors have the halachic status of certainty for us. But it appears in general that we consider their pronouncements to have more equivocal status. You know, Rabbi Cook went to physicians and took his children to physicians, but he's saying that from the point of view of halachic analysis, what doctors say is not something that is set in stone. What they say has kind of equivocal status. They themselves could not possibly consider their opinions as certainties. Sometimes one of them or even many of them establish some firm principle in medicine and similarly in other sciences. And then many consider this to be truth. And then another generation comes along and investigates and discovers that the previous opinion was all vanity. That the doctors say something and then a generation later, they're saying something totally different. They have a different theory. That which one builds up, another one knocks down. Their words have the status only of approximations and of intelligent guesses. Accordingly, everything that they say should be considered equivocal. It should be considered a safek. It establishes a safek, and it establishes doubt in our mind. Oh, the doctor said that if I do this, this might happen to me. I should take that safek into mind, but I shouldn't consider that to be an established fact. And now to bring proofs, as Rabbi Cook continues, that the statements of doctors have only equivocal status seems to be almost superfluous. For even their scholars admit that that is the case. The doctors themselves admit this. And it is a poor dough whose own baker declares it to be bad. Beautiful rabbinic saying, the aluva ha'isa, if the baker says this bread that I baked isn't very good, you can count on it not being very good. And so it's just the doctors tell us that they don't know anything, they don't know many things from a point of view of 100% knowledge, but we'll bring proof in any case. It is established in the Talmud Yoma that if a patient says, I'm Yom Kippur, I must eat, and then the doctor says that it isn't necessary, the Talmud says, the heart alone knows its own bitterness. But the patient is believed because only the patient really knows the condition that the patient is in. And so if the patient says, I have to eat on Yom Kippur, the doctor says, oh, actually, it's not necessary because of the medical condition that the patient has. The patient is given food. That's what the Talmud says. The book says, if the doctor's words were considered as the status of certainty, how would we allow the patient's unprofessional assessment to allow eating on Yom Kippur based only on the slim proof text of the heart alone knows its own bitterness? That's not precisely a halachic statement. Lev yodea morat nafsho is not a halachic statement, but because of this principle, we overrule the words of the doctors. And Rav Kook says, many years ago, my colleague in Torah, the great rabbi and the leading physician, Rabbi Menachem Mendel, Dr. Sergei of Riga, made a similar comment to me. Notice the way Rabbi Kook refers to people who are rabbi doctors. He puts the rabbi title beside their personal name, Rabbi Menachem Mendel, and then he puts the doctor beside their family name. Dr. Sergei. I have a friend here who, whenever he sends me an email, he addresses it to Rabbi Marty, Dr. Lachin. Having learned from Rav Kook the way of doing it. So anyways, I once was talking to the leading physician, Rabbi Menachem Mendel, Dr. Sergei in Riga, and he made a similar comment to me. He said that doctors do not consider their own words to have more than the status of probable. They consider it to be rov, al kol panim leyoter me rov. They know that it's like the majority of evidence leaps in this direction, and so it's not a fact, and it changes in the next generation. In the next generation, it changes. They all admit that they make mistakes, and it just. Because I mentioned this Dr. Sergei, I thought I would just share with you an interesting story about Rabbi Kook and Dr. Sergei. It was written by Rabbi Kook's son, Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Kook, who is my Rosh Yeshiva here in Jerusalem, in Yeshivat Merkaz HaRav. I didn't learn this story in Yeshiva. I discovered it in this journal called Hakira here. Anybody wants to read about it can read about it here. I've got the link here. When my saintly father, Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, visited Sergei as a patient, he offered to pay for his examination and consultation. Sergei adamantly refused to accept payment under any circumstance. I was then a child, not yet 13 years of age, and I told him that he should consider the words of Chazal in Baba Kama, which I was learning at the time, that a physician who heals for nothing is worth nothing. That's a statement in the... So the Talmud really believes that you should be paying your doctor. And if you go to a doctor who isn't accepting any payment, then you shouldn't be counting on the services that you're getting from the doctor, because if he's worth nothing if he's healing for nothing. And this doctor said, Gay answered, he responded that this statement applies only to non-believing irreligious physicians, for whom their entire value of life is measured by the money that they gain. For them, if they do not receive financial compensation, indeed, they are healing for nothing. For me, however, the merit of treating such a great Torah scholar is worth far more than any monetary gain. And so I, therefore, am not healing for nothing. And so that's why Dr. Sergei said that he didn't want to accept the payment from Rabbi Cook. A little off the topic of Bible commentaries, but I thought it was interesting. Next. Okay, let's see what was happening. I see that the chat has been booming. Someone's worried that I was having trouble with the connection. Not that I know of. I wonder whether the Latin name Agrippa might clarify the meaning of the Hebrew word Egrof. Was his name, his nickname Rocky? Interesting, so that's Gershon. With the fist. Could it be that the fist leads to someone, for example, falls, strikes his head, and then dies? Of course, that could happen. But I in my meager understanding of Western law and of Jewish law, I don't think that that would be considered first-degree murder. If I, being the weakling that I am, if I, God forbid, were to punch somebody and they were to fall over backwards and they were to hit their head and they were to die because they hit their head, I don't think the Jewish law or Western secular law would consider that to be first degree murder. No punitive damage, whether he was trying to harm him seriously, no additional. Oh, there are punitive. There are those five categories that I mentioned of payment, which includes pain and suffering, which, as we all know, and can be measured in a very large way. Ibn Ezra had a serious illness, Irene writes, in northern France, and vowed that if he was cured, he would write a second intro to the Torah there, which he did in Rouen. So I guess, I don't know, was he here, healed by going to a physician, or was he healed by going to God? Bloomberg's right. Is this really a comment on the position of halakha on medicine, but rather a comment on the state of medicine at the time? I think very likely that that is the case. And you don't find Jews writing things like that in the 20th or the 21st centuries. The closest that we come to it is Rav Kook saying there that, you know, he went to doctors, but he said that I don't think that their pronouncements have the status of certainty. They have the status of rov. The majority of evidence leads in that way, but people who live a halachic life often use rov as a category for deciding what it is that they will do. This wasn't medical test treatment in the past often a very unscientific thing? Yes. Doesn't this contradict the law that one must do everything to save a life? Well, I guess that you would say, well, what does one do? Well, you have to do things to save a life, but should I be going to the prophet or should I be going to the physician? Shows how great Irene writes the book was on Mike chief rabbis today. What a mensch. Yes, Irene, don't quote me, but I agree with you. Surely these views of undermining the need to have medical practitioners is predicated on the limited knowledge of the human anatomy and of the scientific knowledge the world has become aware of that was current in the Middle Ages. Okay, again, defending our situation is different today than it was in the days of medieval medicine.
Irene says, you obviously haven't used the NHS in the UK. I won't go there. I recall that that convention placing a doctor title before the given name, but after the given name, but before the surname was followed in the Yiddish language Allgemeiner Journal years ago. Thank you very much for pointing that out. I thought this was just, it may have been, maybe the Allgemeiner Journal decided to follow Rav Kook. Maybe it was
Marty.
Yes. Let me just finish with the questions that are here.
Okay.
Sure. Intentions count. If someone dies as a result of an intended injury, then I think it would be second degree murder or manslaughter. I agree totally, but it wouldn't be first degree murder if I punched somebody and I punched them intentionally and through some freak, even though I'm a weakling, they were to die. I think, be charged with either second degree murder or manslaughter. Rabban was a doctor himself. Yes. Who was a greater doctor, Rambam or Ramban? I don't know. Okay. Yes.
He said go to a prophet, but I thought a prophet's job wasn't to foretell the future but was to say what God felt was the warnings about what will happen if, as opposed to yes, do this because this will save you. That isn't supposed to be a prophet's job.
So the question of the definition of a prophet is discussed much in Jewish texts, but I think the best definition of a prophet is a person who brings messages from human beings to God and from God to human beings. And God could tell me, go get a fifth COVID shot. if I went to the prophet, it's possible that something like that could happen. Then you could get a message.
It seems so contradictory, because when you are in a desert, you only have enough water for yourself, and there's someone else, you're not supposed to share it because you're supposed to save at least one life, and all of that, and then suddenly we're saying, doctors, even then, we're still supposed to know more about health than the average person. It should be at least one method to live.
Yes, for sure. As I said, I'm not attracted to the approach of Ibn Ezra or of Ramban, but I do find it interesting, and I apologize. I know that there is at least one physician who is looking on here. And I'm trying to see that physician's eyes to see his reaction to all of these texts, but it's not the common Jewish approach. And all of you who pointed out that it may be a function of how lousy medicine was in medieval times, that could very well be the case. Okay, I think we're going to leave it here. Thank you, everyone who came, and we will continue with the following verses next week. Have a good week.